Bishop Athanasius Schneider recently came out with a essay on whether or not a pope can say heretical things, and if a pope does say heretical things, is he automatically deposed? Is he still the pope? This is a question that has been swirling around more and more as we go into the pontificate of Pope Francis year by year. And we're going to talk about this essay and all the implications of it. This is a topic that a lot of people have asked for. And I think it's great that Athanasius Schneider is the one who broke the ground on it. So, Tim, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. You know, I'm shocked on this because when I saw Schneider come out with this, and we're a little bit slow on it. This is just week old, I think. I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to blow up. This is a new Dubia moment. Everyone's going to post it. It's been crickets. Everybody's ignored this.
Yeah. Yeah, it has been strange. There are only so many of these incremental letters that the faithful and the mostly faithful are willing to abide before they just start ignoring every other one. Yeah, I thought so too. It's hard to predict what's going to go big in the Catholic news realm at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was a much more significant contribution to the debate. And, you know, the Pope Francis pulling his ring away from everybody, kissing everyone. I mean, I find that sad and scandalous. I'm not a fan of it. Did a video on it already. But I mean, it means a lot because it signifies a lot, but it's not as big as, say, things Francis has said.
Of course, no. Theologically, no, that's basically nil, the right. Ring kissing thing. This theologically, and this is probably the reason why so few have taken an interest in it, is much more impactful and has more, you know, gravitas.
Yeah, I mean, here we have a prominent bishop, Athanasius Schneider. Anyone in the who's following the news knows who Athanasius Schneider is. He's a bishop from Kazakhstan. We did a show on him. What was that, a week, 2 weeks ago?
And here he writes, shows on him. Yeah.
Yeah, he writes an essay on the question of a heretical pope in reference clearly to this present pontificate, and everybody ignores it. He gets on, you know, LifeSite and 1 Peter 5, the usual places you would see this, but even there, it doesn't, you know, it's not like getting retweeted. I mean, is that because people are afraid to talk about a heretical pope?
I think it has something to do with the fact that the two or three different significant factions in the church have already chosen their position. Say the three factions in the church have already chosen their position. Group A, for whom maybe they've decided in their own mind anyway, that they think Pope Francis is a heretic. They think, yeah, old news, you know, move on, carry on. Group B, who is the group that doesn't ever address, maybe doesn't really care, just, you know, continues to sing and clap for Go Make a Difference, continues not to care, doesn't even read Catholic sites. And group C, the opposite people like Sedevacantists, who say that the second a pope, you know, looks at you cockeyed or sneezes or whatever, he has deposed himself and is an anti-pope and all of that. They called this out a long time ago, and obviously they're not interested in what Athanasius Schneider has to say anyway, because he acknowledges an anti-pope.
Exactly. I think that's right. I think, well, and there it is, TNT.
Got
mug, my coffee mugs. When you drink those, your coffee's 30% deeper. yeah, I think that there's also maybe another group in there who is not sure. They're like, boy, Pope Francis, he sure doesn't feel like a pope or sound like a pope. He's saying things that make me feel uncomfortable, and they don't really know how to handle it. And so I think those people either ignore these things, or a big temptation is to be a resignationist and say, well, somehow Benedict XVI, he's still the pope, covertly. And, you know, it's kind of like when in America people say Trump, not my president. They say Francis, not my pope. But it's like their own personal decision. Like, in my heart, I've elected Benedict, not Francis.
Right.
And I can understand that, but that's not theologically sound.
Right. Very understandable position. It's in a way one, you know, it's one is nostalgic for that sort of position. I mean, in a way, it's much simpler. The moral categories and ecclesiological categories of the world are much clearer that way. This way is actually less clean. But so, yeah, of course. And I did forget about them. They are a distinguishable fourth group. But it's clearly that is not the case, you know, quite clearly. Let me take a moment and just say, I think this is an important aspect of this letter that it kind of just occurred to me that is worth not missing. When I'm not endorsing the view that Francis is a heretic, but I'm endorsing the view that he either is or is as close as you can be without being one. So that's still a cop out agnostic thing.
Let me go one better
to say.
While we're kind of throwing down our cards here. I think that the Pope has said heretical things. We've said that over and over on TNT. Right. I just don't believe that anyone can judge the first C, the apostolic C.
Right. No, that's right.
And this is basically what Schneider says. We're going to go through the whole thing with Schneider.
Okay. So let's use that as the category, because that's safe while not copping out. The proof is in the pudding. The fact that he's at least said heretical things, or might be this, might be, you know, just north of the line or just south of the line, but at any rate has said heretical things. When one crosses a moment in history, when the case is as strong as it is, it's just from a historical perspective that one has a pope, you know, one's holy father has done this. Then all one has to do, I'm referring to Bishop Schneider, is pen and a kind of essay on the situation without even naming the name of the Pope, Pope Francis. I mean, look at it's at the same time it's very audacious, and at the same time it's not as audacious as other things that that Bishop Schneider has done, because all he's done is penned a letter saying let's talk about this important, he might have said timely, I don't think he said timely, this important issue of what a Pope has to do to depose himself doctrinally. And actually, it's nothing. He can't do anything. That ends up being his thesis statement. We'll get to that in a second. But I once wrote an article for American Thinker. This seemed to have got me in some trouble. My mail was being opened. This is back in 2012, where I just said, this is for the American Thinker. I said, let's assess. This is an analogy, obviously. At this point in American history, this is in late 2012 after President Obama got reelected. I was making a historical point. Let's assess 1775, the causes impelling the separation, the violations of natural rights, versus what we have nowadays. And they're clearly worse nowadays. And I was like, let's just assess them in objective terms, and we'll see whether or not, you know, the subtext is whether or not a 1776 moment will be necessary again. The point is there. When a case is really well instantiated before you, all you have to do is lay out the general template and say, huh, this is the case for a pope. Athanasius Schneider didn't even have to say, here's why it's relevant. You know, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks itself.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody penned this argument, prominent bishop or cardinal, in, say, 1910, I'd be like, why are you writing this?
Right.
But right now this comes out. And actually, I'm going to read the opening here just because I think most people haven't read this, and I want to put it in context. So this is Bishop Athanasius Schneider, his essay on the question of a heretical pope. Opening paragraph, quote, "The issue of how to handle a heretical pope in concrete terms has not yet been treated in a manner which approaches anything like a true general consent in the entire Catholic tradition. So far, neither a pope nor an ecumenical council has made relevant doctrinal pronouncements, nor have they issued binding canonical norms regarding the eventuality of how to handle a heretical pope during the term of his office," end quote. So he's basically saying, we do not have clear magisterial teachings on the situation in which we live. And this causes, obviously, confusion. And what Schneider's going to do here is he's going to say, well, let's go with what we've got. Let's look at a few historical examples and try to get some clarity. But I think there's some humility at the beginning where he's just saying, look, the Council of Trent doesn't have a canon on this.
Right. Right. And what, and the important subtext in his opening is that what we've got is sufficient to the case to make a determination here, even though it's unprecedented that a pope deposes himself. That is not in itself evidence that a pope even can depose himself, which is, of course, what he's going to go on to say. So it is important that he opens that way.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to read the next paragraph, too, because that gives us some historical examples. This is Schneider again, quote, "There is no historical case of a pope losing the papacy during his term of office due to heresy or alleged heresy. Pope Honorius I, who was pope from 625 to 638, was posthumously excommunicated by three ecumenical councils, the Third Council of Constantinople in 681, the Second Nicene Council in 787, and the Fourth Council of Constantinople in 870, on the grounds that he supported the heretical doctrine of those who promoted monothelitism, thereby helping to spread this heresy. In the letter with which Saint Pope Leo II, he's pope from 682, 683, short pontificate, confirmed the decrees of the Third Council of Constantinople, he declared the anathema on Pope Honorius, stating, we anathematize Honorius, stating that his predecessor Honorius, instead of purifying this apostolic church, permitted the immaculate faith to be stained by a profane treason." End quote. So here we have a pope in the early 600s, Honorius I, not Saint Honorius. And just to give you all the background here, because Schneider doesn't, I don't think he provides it. The monothelite heresy said that Christ had only one will, one energy, the divine. And Orthodox Catholicism teaches that Christ has a human will because he's fully man, and he has a divine will because he's fully God, and that the divine will and the human will are linked up like a ladder. They never deviate. Christ never sins. Christ never goes off of God's, the divine will, right? His human will and the divine will are perfectly linked. This is why in the garden he says, not my will, but thy will be done. Pope Honorius wrote the Patriarch of Constantinople, and in that letter, I went and looked it up, he says one or two wills. The Patriarch of Constantinople only believed in one. So mm-hmm. Here you have a pope saying one or two, but he doesn't actually say, no, it's only one and be straight heretical, but right. He says one or two. So he allows for the heretical position. And because of this, three councils excommunicated the pope, and a pope, Saint Leo II, also declared anathema on the dead Honorius.
Three posthumous councils declared him. Right. That's the beating heart of all this.
Precisely. So I think what Schneider's saying here, if we just get right down to it, he's like, look, the next pope could come out and say, Francis said A and B. And by the way, Schneider explains the A and B, the two heretical things. He doesn't mention Francis except for two times. And in both of those cases, he shows where heresy's been taught, error has been taught by Francis. So a future pope could come out and say, Francis was heretical on these topics. We strike them from the records. Anathema. They could even say anathema, just like Leo right. did to Honorius. Or a council could come out and make that decision under papal ratification.
He's saying to people, I believe, again, the subtext, hang on to your hats. Yeah. You know, most of the people reading this letter, taking an active interest in it, are younger by a generation or more than the pope. And this could be yet to come. It has a real theological impact in the terms of boots on the ground, where you have people, the two sides of this, that are either lockstep with the Pope or sharing the same common assumption with the lockstep with the Pope people, the idea that the Pope can't err or else he would not be Pope during his life. You know, these are the people that have said, like the Sedevi contest, that he's deposed himself. He's saying, hang on to your hats. This is not actually right. We'll see how wrong he was after the next conclave at some point.
Right. Right. So then Schneider, he goes and just shows how this idea of Honorius being anathematized by a pope and three councils is received in the Catholic tradition. He notes that in the breviary that this was read and repeated. He said, here's a great quote. It recognized the sixth ecumenical council, which smote with eternal anathema. I wish we could talk like this again. Smote with eternal anathema. The originators of the heresy of monothelitism, Sergius, Pyrrhus, together with Honorius, the Pope's name. So once again, he is smitten. That's right. All right. Smote, smitten. Yeah, he is smitten.
Smitten.
With eternal anathema. Reminds me of the quote from Gandalf. I don't know if it's in the book or if it's just in the movie where he fights the that fire beast. He's, and I smote his ruin upon the mountain.
Yeah, the Balrog book, of just Morgoth. The
movie? Is that just in the book or just the movie?
Where he says, I smote his ruin on the mountainside. I honestly don't know if that's in the book as well.
It's a great line, man.
It's a great quote. There's a great scene.
Yeah.
And yeah, who doesn't want to smote their enemy on the mountainside? To smite
I smote his eternal anathema
on the mountainside.
On the mountainside.
I like
the t-shirt. Yeah, I mean, right there, man.
There's a bit of papal grandiloquence that one misses. You know, you read things like this, and it's like these guys knew how to turn a phrase, especially when things mattered.
Well, it's also worth noting here, folks. You know, nowadays they'll say, well, you know, the Pope, you know, he kind of said it this way and he kind of said it that way. Look, they are smiting him with eternal anathema, the Pope, for saying, yeah, it could be one or two wills in Christ. It's all good. Yeah. Right. He's not even coming out and saying anyone who says two wills will go to hell. I only teach one will. I'm firm on it. Bang the desk.
Right.
No, he says one or two wills. And for that, Pope Honorius is smote with eternal anathema.
Yes, it's quite a punishment for a disjunctive, not even a conjunctive. You know, he's not even saying, oh, it's one and two wills, to say or. And you're like, I'm going to smite your ruin on the mountainside if it were up to me.
Right.
It's hardcore. It is.
It is.
Now,
it
didn't Honorius, I guess you could say, to add to the force of that criticism, he was known for favoring the monothelites, right?
I don't think so. I, from my read on it, I could be wrong. I've only done a little bit of research on it, but he basically wanted to keep everybody united. The context is you just have the monophysite, the monophysite heresy. Mm-hmm. Which taught Christ only has a divine nature.
Right.
The human nature was absorbed and sucked up into the divine nature.
Right.
And that had caused over a century of schism and debate. This is when the Egyptian church broke off, which is the Coptic church, the Ethiopian church, the Armenian church, I think the Georgian church, part of the Syrian church broke off. So I think the Pope is just trying to preserve the unity. So he's saying, hey, one or two, you know, whatever, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, you guys say one, Christ has one will, we say two will. You know, let's just be ecumenical.
Potato, potato. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
People today might be like, yeah, look, one or two wills, why is it a big deal? It's a big deal because as it goes back to St. Athanasius, not Bishop Athanasius, that, you know, whatever, in order for our human nature to be healed, Christ has to fully assume it. So whatever he doesn't assume is not healed. Our will by original sin is broken. Therefore, Christ must assume a human will and redeem the human will. So if Christ didn't have a human will, we can't be saved. So it's a big deal. And that's why the church condemns them.
Not to mention, it's useful. I think this is the way I teach it. It's the very rough and ready version. But all of these heresies, which split off of Arianism for the next four centuries, were, I always just teach them to my students as like a pendulum swing. Right. Yeah. I mean, Arianism is that Christ was more God, more man than God. Then you get monophysitism, which is that he's more God than man. And then you get, OK, well, that's wrong. So we figured out both extremes are wrong. So then you get Apollinarianism and Nestorianism saying, OK, well, people are trying to work out how can he be fully God and fully man.
Right.
So then it's like, OK, well, his natures might be divisible. And then you get into a little bit later monothelitism. And it's like, they're just trying to work out the hypostatic union, how he's both.
Correct. Yeah. So it's a big deal. Like, this is not incidental. Yeah. I think modern people, and especially modern Catholics who have been affected by a little bit of modernism here and there, are like, let's just let everybody kind of understand Jesus in their own way. And the early church says, no, you understand it this way. Now, the Sede Vacantists, who have been circling us like buzzards, I'm sympathetic towards him, honestly. I'm not a Sede Vacantist, never will be, but I will be when the Pope dies. Well, I'll be Sede Vacantist, and that
for at least careful, a few weeks. People don't know. Yeah. People are like, what did you say? Yeah, everyone is.
We'll
Catholic
do a show.
Is.
When the next Pope, when the Pope resigns or passes to his reward, we'll do a, we have decided to become Sede Vacantist this week, the whole week of our Sede Vacantism. No, but
talk
seriously.
About something to offset the LBs. They're going to be like, they said it. You are too until we get another Pope.
They'll be capturing the screen, the audio and the video and reproducing it for decades to come. No,
dangerous,
but I mean, you can sympathize with what they're saying, because they're saying, look, if a Pope is a heretic, he's not professing the Catholic faith purely. Right. So he's not a Catholic. How can a non-Catholic be the head of the church? Doesn't make any sense, especially when your job and your charism is to preserve the faith of the church. That's like saying the head of the Plumbers Guild is not a plumber. Like, what?
Right.
Doesn't make any sense. Right. So you can understand the logic of that. And they'll cite also, you know, canons or certain decrees that say that a heretic cannot hold office. The problem is, and Athanasius Schneider here shows that when we talk about heresy, it's not just like you're walking down the street and the Pope says, you know, I think Christ has one nature. And like before he takes the next step, he's like, poof, not a Catholic. And he loses all his offices and benefices. It's not how it works. Right. Heresy is, yes, it's a wrong belief. But in the church, it's also a canonical crime.
Right.
Like Martin Luther taught heresy. But a canonical process went through to declare the crime of his heresy and depose him. So when you read those canons, right, or you read theologians who say a heretic loses his office, it's not just heresy, like walking down the street and he says something like, I think there might be 8 sacraments today. It's it's the crime of heresy. You're tried, right? And you persevere in that heresy.
Right.
And so, obviously, that never happened in the life of Honorius, as far as we know. But there was a trial at 3 ecumenical councils, or at least the first one, right, where it was declared. So there needs to be a declaration. And the problem is right now, there is no, well, there is authority over Pope Francis. It's Jesus Christ. But he doesn't come down, usually, and hold trials. So the highest authority in the church is the Pope, so only he can try himself. He could. I mean, I'm praying for this all during Lent. I'm fasting for the Pope, for this reality, that he is saying his morning offering or he's doing his examination of conscience, and he says, you know what? I messed up there. And he could come out and he could try and accuse himself. And he could say, because of that, I'm resigning, or he could say, I am now repudiating errors in this document or whatever. So he has the authority to do that to himself, but Cardinal Burke doesn't have that authority. Bishop Schneider doesn't have that authority. Vatican III, even if we called it, doesn't have that authority. The College of Cardinals doesn't have that authority. And that is why I cannot join up with the Sede Vacantis, because at the end of the day, they're saying, I, as a private layman or a priest, have judged the Pope of the crime of heresy.
Vatican III could only do it if it were posthumous to the death of Francis.
Correct.
Of course.
Yes,
yeah, you mean if it's during his life. There's this great
Because then
line.
You have another pope who of has course. Authority.
Yeah. Of course, but it wouldn't be a Sede Vacantis situation. Where, exactly. Yeah. Here's this great line substantiating everything you just said. In some ways, for me, this was kind of the high point of the article. Schneider writes, the Pope gets his authority directly from God and not from the Church. Therefore, the Church cannot depose him for any reason whatsoever. That's just theological simplicity. I really appreciate lines like that. This is what primacy means in terms of the Pope's office. He gets his authority directly from God. There's no mediating structure for him. And as much as I'd understood primacy, or, you know, to whatever extent I'd misunderstood it, this one simple sentence in good, clear writing makes it, you know, clarifies it still further in my mind. That's great. That's everything you're saying. It doesn't matter whether or not he might later be declared to be a heretic. The Pope's authority is non-mediated. It's immediate. It comes directly from God until he dies or deposes himself explicitly. Everyone else, even say cardinals at any time in the history of the Church that might be more shrewd, more clever, more faithful, better saints, you know, actual saints when the Pope might not be a saint, they still have immediate authority, an authority mediated by the Church itself. Great, okay. Great line. It backs up everything you just said.
And the Pope can reach out and take a red hat from a cardinal.
Yes.
And they, if he was like, well, I want to appeal that. And the Pope could say, okay, you can appeal it. I'm the one that you appeal to. Never
right,
no one
exactly.
else. You can't
exactly.
appeal it to those five other cardinals. So I guess the Pope could say, you can appeal it, appear on Tuesday and make your case. You can bring a canon lawyer with you. And I might change my decision and give you your hat back. But if I don't, it stands, because there is no other authority. There's no king, parliament, courts. The Pope, even the apostolic signatura, is at the discretion of the Pope. He can always overturn anything. And it is
right.
He's not bound by the apostolic signatura, which is the Supreme Court of the Church. So
like,
he's even higher than canon law. He's above canon law.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you call it like a DMV appeal. It's like when you go to the lady and you're like, oh, you're going to make me wait 2 hours in line. And she's like, yeah. And then you're like, is there any way that I can speed this up? Because yesterday I was here and they said they'd get me right to the front of the line. Can I appeal this? And she's like, sure. Go to the back of the line. I just reconsidered it. You know, it's rough when your appeal does not bring you before a new judicial body, you know.
You're out of luck. That's right. So the Pope is that DMV worker. You know, I mean, you get to a certain level and you stop, and that's just Catholicism, guys. I mean, Honorius, he said something heretical. He did not stand up for the truth of the Church. Did he, in that moment, lose the papacy? No. You look at the annals of the papacy, and his papal dates run up to his death. There's no blips in there where, oh, these few years he was Pope. These few years he was Pope. These few years he wasn't, flipping on, flipping off. No, he was the Pope. Now, I mean, there's two people who don't like this, Tim. There's your modernist Catholics, go make a difference. And for them, the Pope is the Oracle of Apollo. If a Pope 100 years ago said the death penalty is just and good, and then this Pope says, no, it's sinful, it's bad, it's inadmissible, whatever words you want to use. They're like, well, you go with the new Pope because he's the oracle.
Right.
And they're like, well, how can both be true? And they're like,
because
well, don't worry
doctrine
about it.
Evolves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, or even it changes. They'll even say it changes.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay, but you're a modernist. And they're like, we don't care. The Pope says that. So it's an oracle. The Pope in this scenario is not the guardian and guarantor of tradition. He is the oracle. We don't believe that, right? So
right.
They don't like this. But also your Sede Vacantis, they want a pristine, the Pope can never teach error. And they have all kinds of things and hoops to jump around with Honorius to show that he wasn't really condemned or he didn't really teach heresy when up. It's like a sainted pope anathematized him, three councils. I mean, we're not just talking about a disputed passage in Dentinger or church history. This is right on the books.
Right.
A pope was anathematized. It can happen. It happened once, it could happen again.
And again, I keep coming back to both sides. They're two distinct sides. You're definitely right there. But the funny thing is, for both sides, a pope can never err practically. For the one side, it's because they say doctrine will just evolve. If you get a conservative pope, you'll get conservative legislation, vice versa with liberals. The other, so they like it. The other side doesn't like it, right? They're like, this is bad. So we agree with that side insofar as, yeah, I don't like heretical or quasi-heretical things any more than the Sedes do. But the Sedes agree as to the ultimate question at hand here, more with the modernist, you know, sort of typical know-nothing Catholics, insofar as the Pope can never err and retain his office. That's the received position of both sides.
I've listened to some Sede Vacante stuff and read some other stuff, like the good stuff, not like, you know, I mean, well, whatever. I mean, I've looked at their stuff and they say, look, if Francis says this, if you believe Francis is the Pope, you are obliged to follow him all the way over the cliff.
That's what I mean.
You can't say, well, I follow Pope Francis only in like 90% of his stuff. They're like, no. He is the Pope. You follow him over the cliff. If he says God wills the diversity and plurality of religions, and Schneider again quotes this in this essay.
He does.
Have to walk around and say that God wills many religions. And if you don't, you're a hypocritical Catholic. That's precisely my point.
Yeah, that's my point, which is what the know-nothing modernists in the church say. Like, yeah, we do.
Exactly. The Pope said it. Yeah. So how do we carve out a position which has been traditionally either known or sometimes it's even mocked as the recognize and resist? That is, we recognize that is the true Pope right there in the white cassock. That's the Pope. But we resist him on A, B, C, and D. Both groups say you can't do that. And we're saying, no, we can do that. And the classic appeal is to Galatians, where Paul resists Peter. And if you look in the Vulgate, it actually is the word resist
in Latin.
Right. So Paul resists Peter. Obviously, Paul recognized Peter as the Pope in his primacy, in his jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But he also resists him publicly. And that didn't make Paul un-Catholic or non-Catholic.
Yeah. In Athanasius Schneider's terminology here, there's a difference between saying, these are two different statements. He says, on the one hand, A, the Pope is not the church in toto, right? So that's A. At the same time, he says something that a non-shrewd, non-careful reader might take to be the same thing, and it's actually not, or the opposite thing, that, quote, the Pope gets his authority directly from God, and therefore the church cannot depose him for any reason whatsoever. The Pope is, at the same time, if you combine those two statements, I think it combines our answer to the Sedes. It's the Pope is not the church in toto. He's not ecclesium in toto. He can't speak infallibly for the church unless he does ex cathedra, but he is not the entire church. Yet he is the only member of the body with unmediated power, with power that is in an office that is not mediated by the church. That's where why everyone's tripping up on this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very clear. We got to repeat that over and over so that we understand that as Catholics.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's why you get together with the lefties and the righties, you know, you really 90 to 95% of Catholic people trip up on that distinction. It's that distinction Schneider makes. That's why it's so few that are like, yeah, I'm Catholic. No, I'm not with the Pope when he talks about A, B, C, D, or E, or F, or G, in the case of this book.
Right.
it's so few. It's a small group that get this relatively simple distinction. It's simple. It's not easy.
Now, if Pope Francis said, "I am making an ex cathedra statement on faith and morals. It is binding on the faithful, and it is this: God wills the plurality and diversity of religions." That would be binding. At that point, you would have to either choose your modernist God, or the Pope can change, evolve dogma, or at that point, you would have to be a sedevi contest.
That is correct.
But you wouldn't be a sedevi contest because the Pope just opposed himself. I don't see how that's possible. And yes, they'll cite some things from Robert Bellarmine and whatnot, but that's not the magisterium per se. It's Robert Bellarmine. I know he's a doctor of the church. But he wouldn't just be, you'd have to say, well, somewhere along the line, he wasn't validly elected. I mean, you'd have to start figuring some stuff out. If that happened, folks, I'm not saying it. If that happened, if a pope got on there, sat down on the altar of the chair and said, ex cathedra, God wills the plurality and diversity of religions, we'd have a long TNT show on that. I don't know. We'd have to...
Well, that's unprecedented, because that's why it would be such a long TNT, because it's I mean, it's not unprecedented that a pope in his, I don't know if it's his ordinary magisterium or just plane pressers, you know, did Honorius fly around on a plane and say silly things the way Francis does, whether it's considered his ordinary magisterium or not, I don't want to err there, but it's not his extraordinary magisterium, and that's the only time we would have the long TNT, and we'd be in trouble.
There's another pope that comes in the conversation on these topics, and Bishop Schneider brings him up, and that's John the 22nd, not John the 23rd, who we know is the pope who's opened the Second Vatican Council. John the 22nd, 22. He was Pope from 1316 to 1334, and he's also relevant to this discussion, and Schneider cites him because he also taught heresy. Now, he didn't teach it ex cathedra. He didn't write any documents and bind the consciences of the faithful, but he taught wrongly that the faithful, including the Blessed Mother herself, do not receive the beatific vision until the end of time.
Yeah.
So that would be like right now, Peter, Paul, the Blessed Mother, the Little Flower, anyone, name any saint. They do not have the vision of the divine essence as St. Thomas Aquinas taught 100 years before this, actually less than 100 years before this. And so he held to this position, and he had disputations held in front of him. It was well known that he taught this. In fact, I think it was William of Ockham. Was it Ockham? I think it was William who admonished him.
I didn't know.
Even though William of Ockham is not a great theologian, he's got major problems. So it's not just like a few people in the papal court. Like, did you hear that sermon that last week? That was no. This is well known. Like, kings know about it. Cardinals, theologians. It's an international held knowledge that the Pope holds this peculiar position, and it is true. At the end of his life, John the 22nd. Repudiate it. He says, I was wrong. I made a mistake. He even issues a papal document saying, hey, I was wrong for holding this. And I want the world to know that I have embraced the Orthodox position. The Blessed Mother and the saints have the beatific vision now. And then we'll have it again. We'll continue to have it at the end of time. So here again, a pope is teaching error. It's well known that he's teaching error. It's not ex cathedra. And yet, guess what? He's still pope. He doesn't lose it. The switch doesn't go off and then come back on when he says, I was wrong. Like a sedevi contest might, like a really immature sedevi contest might say.
Right.
Like, well, anytime he just says something on the street, he loses the papacy. Obviously, that didn't happen with John the 22nd.
Yeah, we always talk about Honorius, John the 22nd. It was out there, his error. So out there that he himself acknowledged it. Like you said, it was not like one theologian being like, dude, come here, bro, check this. I'm reading chapter 8 of John the 22nd's document. Check this footnote, bro. You know, it wasn't that. It was that out there. That's what people don't understand. And he still wasn't. What we're saying is there's not a kind of late sentente excommunication of the papacy itself. right? That executes itself. Like, even for a way out there Honorius or John the 22nd kind of heretical teaching, it can be out there for years until he either repents, which is really for the good of his own soul, I guess, the good of papal teaching, the papal magisterium writ large. But really, he's saving himself, John the 22nd, or Honorius. I don't think he ever did repent, did he?
I don't think Honorius, we have no record of him recanting or bringing back that statement or anything like that. He seems to have died holding that position. Now, John the 22nd, I like this detail. We're Thomas Tim, so we're going to really like this, get our pom-poms out. But Schneider writes this: although many clergy, including Franciscan friars, spread this doctrine, that is the false doctrine of John the 22nd, Dominicans publicly admonished the Pope, along with the entire University of Paris, with the backing of King Philip VI of France. So here you have, so this isn't, sometimes when you read some of the immature, lame Sede Vacantist apologists, they don't understand. They'll say, oh, well, John the 22nd, that's just his private opinion. No, you have the entire University of Paris, ground zero for theological disputation, the Dominican order, and the King of France admonishing the Pope, like, dude, you are in error. You are teaching and entertaining heresy in the Catholic Church. And he was still the Pope.
Right.
He did not lose the papacy.
Yeah, none of this was behind the scenes. They didn't have the internet, but it was all in the higher reaches of the church, in public life, in the higher reaches of the church.
Yep. And then he goes on to say, Cardinal Jacques Fournier fraternally corrected the Pope. Fournier eventually became the successor as Pope Benedict XII. So the cardinal who got into his face and said, dude, you're wrong. The Blessed Mother and the saints have the beatific vision. He actually resisted the Pope. He was kind of a Cardinal Burke guy. And he became the next Pope.
Yeah.
Lord hear it.
Yeah,
well, Lord hear it.
Yeah. is past prologue? Is history just a glimpse?
History repeats itself. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is well known. I mean, and we seem to have a similar situation now.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's undoubtable that we have at least a somewhat similar situation now, because these are not private. These are not whisperings, you know, fourth hand that the Pope might have said X, Y, or Z. I mean, we are living in a post Amoris Laetitia world, and there's been so many more transgressions since then. So we are in this headspace, and it's, in some ways, isn't it surprising that Bishop Schneider only comes forth with a document like this for the first time, and it's unprecedented with all the other guys that are recognizing and resisting?
I mean, I think everybody who's recognized or resists loves this. I mean, we finally have a bishop, you know, since a lot of bishops were saying this in the 70s, but it kind of fell away. The only one who really like persevered in it was Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. But now we kind of have it back out in the open. That's why when I saw the story, I was like, oh, this is going to be amazing, you know. And unfortunately, you know, I had to finish my book and you had your birthday. I mean, all these things, we didn't get to jump on it right away. But then it's been a week and nothing happened. It's almost like we're breaking the news again because nobody jumped on this story. This didn't
get tweeted. It was weird.
It's weird.
Right. No echo chamber. Yeah.
There's this one great spot here towards the end, Tim. And this is where it's interesting that Schneider doesn't mention Pope Francis that much. I mean, it's a pretty long essay. I'd encourage everybody to go read it. You can read the full thing on the Life site, or you said First Peter, right?
Yeah, 1 Peter 5, yeah.
Yeah. This came out March 21st. So it's been 1 week.
1 week.
As of the recording of this. But he does mention Pope Francis towards the end in a single paragraph, and he cites two errors. And Tim, you and I have spent a lot of time talking about these two errors in several videos, but I want to read this passage from Schneider. So he says, quote, a theologically revolutionary change was made by, interesting, he doesn't say heresy here. He says a theologically revolutionary change was made.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
What's that?
We know what you're saying. We know.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
So a theological revolutionary, maybe that's what we should start saying. Instead of saying
theological,
a TRC.
It's a TRC, bro.
Yeah, it's a theologically revolutionary change. Was made by Pope Francis insofar as he approved the practice of some local churches of admitting in singular cases sexually active adulterers who are cohabitating in so-called irregular unions to Holy Communion. Even if these local norms do not represent a general norm in the church, they nevertheless signify a denial in the practice of divine truth of the absolute indissolubility of a valid and consummated sacramental marriage, period. He's very specific here. He doesn't say amoris laetitia just said. He says local churches were admitted in singular cases, sexually active adulterers. So he's very precise because he wants people to say you're just making a straw man.
Right. No. That's...
So he does reproduce the situation precisely. And I salute him for that. Then he goes on to say his other alteration in doctrinal question. So there we go. We got first is a theological revolutionary change. And here we have his other alteration in doctrinal questions. Very subtle, but it's basically the H word. If you make an alteration in doctrinal questions, that's a heresy.
Yeah.
His other alteration in doctrinal questions consists in the change of the biblical and constant bimillennial doctrine regarding the principle of the legitimacy of the death penalty.
And the TNT crowd
goes wild.
I was going wild myself.
Yeah. And then here we go for the third one. The next doctrinal change represents the approval of Pope Francis of the phrase in the interreligious document of the Abu Dhabi of February 4th, 2019, which states that the diversity of the sexes, together with the diversity of races and the diversity of religions, corresponds to the wise will of God. This formulation, as such, needs an official papal correction. Otherwise, it evidently will contradict the first commandment of the Decalogue and the unmistakable and explicit teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ, hence contradicting divine revelation, end quote. Boom goes the dynamite. Drop the mic. Bishop Athanasius Schneider.
Yeah. You know that, look, everyone's got their bête noire. Everyone's got their issue. That doesn't mean that it's more important objectively than other issues, but his issue was the third one, you know, and you know that's what prompt. You can see the timeline here. You have amoris laetitia, April 2016. You have the death penalty thing developing about a year ago, a little over a year ago. And then you have the Pope Francis saying that the Lord wills a plurality of religions actively, and he's like, I'm writing it, I'm doing it. You could tell that's what prompted him. 3 weeks later, you know.
Well, Tim, remember when we did the video on Schneider where we had the glasses come down on him and the papal tiara come on him, remember?
Yeah.
And then we showed the picture of them with B16, the puffy jackets.
Yep.
Remember that video?
Yeah.
So I think it was in that video we talk about how at that meeting we'll call up the puffy jacket Kazakh. Oh, someone told me you're not supposed to say Kazakhstani, like Pakistani. You're supposed to say Kazakh.
Kazakhs, yeah.
Okay, so at the Kazakh meeting with Pope Francis and B16, a.k.a. the puffy jacket meeting of the Kazakh bishop, Schneider directly addressed Pope Francis on, hey, what's the deal with God willing, with his divine wise will, the diversity of sexes, and in the same sentence, the diversity of religions. And the Pope says, oh, I meant the passive will of God.
Right.
And he's kind of trying to push it, and then we kind of made up the scenario, like, hey, Athanasius Schneider, we need to have some other conversations with the Pope right now, right?
Right, right.
As of March 21st, he hasn't let go of that bone.
No, he hasn't. And I mean, he kind of got Francis, what he wanted.
Pope Francis took the bone and buried it in the backyard. And then Athanasius Schneider went and dug it up again, and he brought it to the back step.
He did. He's like, you're not getting off that either. I mean, he really did. It's very rare, I'd say, on TNT that you and I characterize things with much daylight between our characterizations at all. But I remember that show after that the puffy jacket meeting. I was like, oh, so he kind of got what he wanted. And of course, you agreed there, but you had a slightly different take on it. The funny thing, I mean, think about it. He really did one-on-one. I mean, this is bragging rights, right? In the church history, he went to the Pope one-on-one or with a small group of his posse.
His
puffy jacketed posse. And he secured from the Pope a kind of, oh, you didn't mean this, right? Because this would be idiotic quasi-heresy. Yeah. And then the Pope was like, no, I guess I didn't mean that, even though he apparently
probably won. He's like, no, I meant the passive will. And then if you read the story, he keeps trying to push it some more. He's like, well, how can it be passive will if it's in the same sentence of him willing the sexes, Adam and Eve?
Right.
God didn't passively will, like, oops, there's actually now male and female, like this other person fell off the rib of Adam and she has different anatomical procreative organs than him. I guess I allowed that to happen, just as sort of I allowed Islam to emerge and ravish the earth. No, I don't think so.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's
bad. So this is, I mean, I might want to print this part out, frame it and put it right here on the wall. So every time we start a TNT, I just look at this mic drop moment from Athanasius Schneider, where I think I said two originally, but actually the three. I think I forgot that he mentioned the death penalty here. And I like how he calls it the constant bimillennial doctrine regarding the principle of the legitimacy of the death penalty.
I love that.
Notice he calls it bimillennial, 2,000 years, but he calls it a doctrine. This is not a discipline.
No.
Can you kill a criminal and it not be a sin is doctrine. It's morality. It's not just sort of a discipline. People need to get that out of their head. We see that in the comments. Well, he's just changed the discipline on death penalty. No, it's doctrine.
It's not related to a rite or a sacrament or a sacramental. It's the teaching on whether
we're not talking about moral the use theology. Of old church Slavonic in certain situations. We're not talking about
right.
that. We're talking about killing a man.
Right. And the church is teaching on certain homicides, state-sanctioned homicides.
Well, that's doctrine. I guess it's a homicide, but yeah. A non-culpable, moral, not just moral, not just tolerated, a just killing of a criminal. Is that okay? Bimillennial doctrine, the church says, yes, it's great.
Yeah, they're defensible homicides, right? This is what it is when someone comes into your house to rob you and you blow them away. This is a justifiable homicide, right? So you don't, even at law, you don't plead innocent to homicide. Homicide itself is not the crime. You say this is a homicide and I raise the affirmative defense of whatever else. Mm-hmm. The state doesn't, well, until you get guys like JP2 and Francis writing about it, it begins to sound like it. State does not need a justification for killing a man. The state holds the prerogative of God. Right. So the state doesn't need what I
need. He holds the sword. He does not hold the sword in vain. That's Paul. And he's referring to Nero. Romans was written during the time of Nero. And guess who ended up killing Paul with the sword? Nero.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah, I know. And Paul did not remember. Also, Paul said, if I have done, well, this isn't a direct quote. He says, in essence, if I've done anything worthy of the death penalty, then put me to death. But I have not done anything, even by the laws of Rome, that warrant the death penalty. So that is a conditional claim. It's an if-then, but except he it is an explicit endorsement in one of the non-conditional parts of the claim of the death penalty.
Right. Well, even Christ our Lord says to Pilate, you would not have this power unless it was given to you on high. What power is that? John. To kill him, folks.
To kill, yeah.
Jesus Christ said that God the Father gave the power to kill him to Pontius Pilate.
To the state. Yep.
It doesn't get any more magisterial than that, folks.
No. So I don't know how they get around.
Let's not
that.
Turn it into a death penalty show because we got at least one of those shows, if not two. Go and see our shows on the death penalty, where we talk about this responsibly through the tradition of the church. I want to cite another paragraph from Athanasius. He says, and this is sort of a what do we do now? Okay, we're in a situation with a troubling papacy. We're not living under Pope St. Pius V or Pope St. Pius X. We're not living under, you know, I don't know, name any of your sainted popes. It's a irregular, difficult situation. Athanasius Schneider says, quote, the extremely rare case of a heretical or even a semi-heretical pope must ultimately be endured and suffered in light of the faith in the divine character and in the indestructibility of the church and of the Petrine office. Pope Saint Leo the Great formulated this truth, saying that the dignity of Saint Peter is not abated in his successors, however unworthy they be.
Right.
So, you know, even Christ our Lord talked about the unjust steward, right, who terrorized, you know, the master went away. Remember, the steward kind of terrorizes the estate, right, even beats people. Who is the steward in the church? Who is the prime minister of the church? The Pope. The Pope is not the king. People need to get this out of their mind, right? He is a monarch of the Vatican City State, but when it comes to the church, he's not the king of the church. Jesus is Christ the king. The Pope is the prime minister. It's like, you have to help me here, Tim. In Lord of the Rings, who's the steward?
Lord Denethor.
Yeah, he's the steward. He starts acting like the king, right? But everybody who knows remembers there is a king out there, a hidden king. He's going to come back one day.
Well, there's a natural tension between Lord Denethor and his sons, particularly Boromir, between the House of Stewards, as it's called, the line of stewards who sit on the low throne. Right. And they're supposed to be awaiting, for the sake of Gondor, right? They're supposed to be eagerly awaiting the return of the king. Maybe the line wasn't broken. They're supposed to be excited for an Aragorn, son of Arathorn type figure. But as soon as the son of Lord Denethor, the son of the steward, meets Aragorn, you know that human nature kicks in. He's not hoping what he ought to be hoping for the common good of Gondor. He wants his family, Boromir, like his father Denethor before him, to continue to sit in the throne of the stewards. This is petty human nature. And yeah, there is something, it is telling. This kind of stuff does go on with all steward king relationships. I mean, not all, but it's possible in all steward king relationships.
That's right. So the Pope's the steward.
Christ
is going to come back, and he's going to rule, and there's not going to be a papacy after Judgment Day. There's no papacy. No need for it. It's just immediate direct rule of Christ the King over all the souls for eternity. But now we have stewards, and we know from history not all stewards are moral, and we know in the case of Honorius and John the 22nd, not all stewards are 100% all the time, 24/7 Orthodox.
Right. Also, just as an aside here, I'm not correcting you because I know what you would say on this. You would, of course, agree. But it sounded when you were saying Jesus is king of the church. The Pope is just the steward of the church. Jesus is king of the church and all the world besides. Right. This Correct. Is one of those. We've gone utterly away from the doctrine of the social kingship of Christ. One of the great duties well discharged by Lefebvre, you know, who was big on this. Christ is the social king of the world, kind of like you said about Sedevacantus with regard to the Pope. The Pope is the Pope. He's the steward of the whole church, whether or not the Sedes acknowledge him. Similarly, it's a subjectivist type moment when you would say Christ is king of all the world, whether or not non-Christians acknowledge him.
Correct. Yeah. Is Christ the king of France right now? Yes. Is Christ the king of Poland?
Socially.
Is Christ the king of China? Yes. Not politically, right? But yeah, socially, he's the king of, there's not one square inch in this galaxy where Christ is not the king. He's king over every place, every person. But we have people who are in rebellion. You read Psalm 2, you know, why the nations rage against the Messiah, against Christ the King, because they want to sin. It's a moral rebellion. But he will put all that rebellion to an end when he returns on doomsday. And there'll be no need for the stewards, popes.
That's right.
Yeah,
that'll be a series of headaches averted. Yeah.
Now, what if the Pope says to you, there's a great example in church history. There is either a cardinal or an archbishop, I forget his name, he's in England, and the Pope told him to place his nephew into a benefice in Lincoln, in England, to gain money, and had no intention of moving to England, but the nephew of the Pope is just going to get the income of that benefice. And the bishop said no to the Pope. He resisted the Pope. And so that's immoral. It's nepotism, right? And he's just getting money for not even doing any pastoral work. In that case, the bishop appeals to Christ the King morally over the Pope. We can't do that. If the Pope told you, hey, I want you to raid this land and bring me the gold, you could resist the Pope. Yeah, or if he told you, if he told you, I want you to change the consecration in the Mass, you could resist that because divine law, right, what we learned from St. Paul and from the Gospels means you can't change that. So we need to remember as Catholics that our allegiance is to Christ the King. And that's wrapped up with our allegiance to the steward, the Pope, always. But if there's ever a disjunction between the morality dictated and revealed by Jesus Christ with what the Pope says, you always go with Christ.
Yeah, you stick with the King if the steward goes away from the King. And for the record, you mean the consecratory formula has to be there in the prayer of consecration.
Or even if the Pope just said, I want, from now on, I want the consecration to be, this is the sippy cup of my bodily fluids.
Sure.
You say, no, we're not doing that. And the Pope says, I decree it.
It lacks the formula. Yeah, it lacks the formula.
Yeah, you say,
they can write a crappy prayer on a napkin and it's valid, but except they can't say, yeah, he can't change what the formula is for consecration.
No. Or if he says, I want you to baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the Blessed Virgin Mary, you resist the Pope and you say, H, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because our allegiance is Christ the King. And that's just something we have to remember. And I also don't want to hear anyone saying I'm disparaging the papacy. Even if there's something somewhat arbitrary that's questionable, you obey the Pope. That's what I'm saying. Right? Because he's the Holy Father. He has that authority. He has supreme and immediate jurisdiction over every baptized person. But there are cases when there's, for example, in Galatians, Peter will not eat with the Gentiles. Paul says that's wrong. And it's endangering the gospel truths. So he resists him to his face. And, you know, people say
him to his face.
Yeah. In the early church, when you're not eating with the Gentiles, it's not just like, hey, what did you guys bring to the picnic? You know, who's going to go to the park and eat lunch with me? It's probably liturgical. It's maybe very highly Eucharistic that there's two separate assemblies. There's one that there's a Gentile Eucharistic kind of second class citizen Eucharistic assembly. And then there's the first class, which is the Judaic ones, the circumcised guys who have been at it for a while before the Gentiles. And it seems
it involves the holding from the recently christened Council of Jerusalem, where it's like, you gotta live this out, bro. We just decided Gentiles, they're kind of weird or whatever. You know, the Jewish Christians are looking at them like they're weird. They don't keep kosher or whatever, but you gotta live this out, bro.
Yeah. They're like, they're not eating kosher and they're not circumcised. So Moses says they're unclean. They're ceremoniously unclean. So when we keep ceremonies like liturgies, how can they be with us? I know, we'll do Jim Crow law, separate but equal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying this actually happened, but this is the kind of thing in the early church.
It kind of did. Yeah.
Yeah, like they'll have their liturgy and we'll have our liturgy and we'll all worship Jesus, but we won't be.
They have their drinking fountain over here. they drink their, what is the Jewish wine called? From a separate bottle or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
It's a very sweet
Manischewitz or something.
Manischewitz. Yeah. That's it. Right.
So and so Paul says, look, that's no good. Christ said, you know, he tore down the division between Jew and Gentile through his flesh, through his blood. He opened the veil. So anyway, let me go to the very end here. Schneider talks a lot about how we can't depose the Pope. No one on earth can do that. And this is the final statement of Schneider. The act of deposition of a pope because of heresy or the declaration of the vacancy of the papal chair because of the loss of the papacy, ipso facto on behalf of a heretical pope would be a revolutionary novelty in the life of the church. And this regarding a highly important issue of the Constitution and the life of the church, period.
Right.
End quote. So this is basically oriented towards those who are sede vacantist or who are sympathetic toward a sede vacantist. And again, I understand where they're coming from. I'm not one that's ready to just start beating down sede vacantist. I understand in the Francis pontificate where they're coming from. I'm not one, but he says, look, to depose a pope or to declare an ipso facto vacancy, he says, would be a revolutionary novelty in the life of the church. And sede vacantist, I think, would admit that. You can't ever say, well, when did that ever happen before? But like, it never did. We just sort of, this is what we're going with. And you're like,
it never happened. This is key to the letter. This I've called like four things the beating heart. So evidently the letter's a cow. But it never happened, even though it had the opportunity to arise. Correct. As such. This is unprecedented, even though you had an Honorius and a John the 22nd. That's what gives the argument all its force.
Right. And then Schneider says, even if it were the case that this revolutionary novel idea that the Pope ipso facto loses the papacy, even if it were, he says, we have to follow the via dutior, the safer way, the sure way. Right. So we have to err on conservatism.
Right.
And so he says, one has to follow in such a delicate manner, even if it is of a practical and not strictly of doctrinal nature, the sure way, the via tutior, of the perennial sense of the church, notwithstanding the fact that three successive ecumenical councils, the Third Council of Constantinople, the Second Council of Nicaea, and the Fourth Council of Constantinople, and Pope Leo II in 682 excommunicated Pope Honorius I because of heresy, they did not even implicitly declare that Pope Honorius I had lost the papacy ipso facto because of heresy. In fact, the pontificate of Pope Honorius I was considered valid even after he had supported heresy in his letters to the Patriarch Sergius in 634, since he reigned after that another 4 years until 638. The following principle formulated by Pope St. Stephen I, although in a different context, should be a guideline in treating the highly delicate and rare issue of a heretical pope. Nihil innovatur nisi quo traditum est. Let there be no innovation beyond which has been handed down. End quote. March 21st, 2019, Athanasius Schneider. Boom.
So that's the whole issue right there. This is not actually unprecedented. We have retroactivity in our declarations of popes and antipopes. Look at the Avignon Papacy and the Great Western Schism, which followed, right? We can go back and we say, oh, now we know this guy wasn't pope. And guess what, people? Guess what, sedes? That was not the course opted for in the case of Honorius. It was 4 years before the end of his papacy. We did not end up going back later and saying, oh, we had an empty chair for 4 years until whoever his who took the throne after he did.
Was it Leo II? Or no, that was I think a little bit later. I have to look it up.
I forget. But that's the point. That would be what it was if that would be the case. If what the kind of two opposite sides of today's church, the modernists and the sedes, if they were right, then you would just go back and with retroactivity, you would say, so he stopped being pope 4 years before the end of his material reign.
That's right.
And it didn't happen.
When he penned the letter to Sergius saying one or two wills, when that letter hit the post office, right?
Right.
When he sent it out, he ceased being pope.
Right.
That morning when he ate breakfast, he was pope. But after he left his study that afternoon, having penned that letter, he was not the pope.
Right.
And you'd have to say it doesn't matter. There was no tribunal. There was no declaration of crime. He, in his soul, became a heretic. He was no longer a Catholic. He was not. And a non-Catholic can't be pope. So in that moment, and come on, guys. Sede vacantist, you need to be a little bit more responsible when it comes to the Honorius. I know people have said, well, go read what Novus Ordo Watch wrote on this. I went and read it. It still doesn't get around this problem.
No.
You know, so
it ignores it.
Yeah, and I agree. There's some smart sedes out there and they have some good arguments. But look, I like what Schneider says here. We must follow the via tutsior, the sure way, the safer way. It's really dangerous to say, hey, there is no pope, there are no more dioceses anymore, there's no more cardinals anymore. I mean, like I've always said, I like to play the penny slots, the nickel slots, the quarter slots. I don't like playing blackjack or any, you know, craps or anything where the stakes are like $1,000 a roll.
Of course.
You know, that's what you're the playing wise like $100 slots when you're saying set a contest. You're saying no more cardinals. No feasible way to get a new pope. No diocese.
You're playing the $100 slots with a kind of like counterfeit money that is certain to, with the kind of evidence we're talking here that Schneider just raises, certain to, even if you risk all your money and you win, it's a kind of counterfeit where it will be called off. We know that this is wrong because this is you and I have even said it. Oh, this is an unprecedented issue. It's precedented because of how he closes the letter. We know that you can't depose a pope even retroactively, even when in a formal letter he supports a heresy. So, yeah.
Well, I think they would say he did. It's the part that's unprecedented is that Leo said you can have orthodoxy or unorthodoxy. You can have one will or two wills. Where in the case of Francis, we have written documents saying God wills the diversity of religion. So that part, Francis is more bold than Honorius.
He's bolder, but it's still openly heretical to say you can believe there are three or four persons in the Trinity. It's like, no, you can't. You really, it's heretical to say anything short of there are only three persons in the Trinity, even if you leave it as a choice.
Yeah, if a pope said you can have three or four persons in the Trinity, that's heretical.
That's heresy. Yeah, that's heretical. So
if you say Christ can have one or two, that's heresy. That's why he got anathematized.
Right. But he wasn't he was anathematized. We don't have to debate it with the Sedes. He was anathematized. So they weren't saying there's no quibbling on that point. The point with the Sedes
is when. He was eternally anathematized, yeah.
Right. When did it kick in though? I mean, it kicked in terms of his office after death. This is a closed issue.
Yep. There it is. That is the recognize and resist position. You recognize the Pope. Where there is error, where there is trouble, you resist. Otherwise, you accept.
Right.
I think that is the historic position in my new book coming out, Infiltration. At the end of it, after you read everything, I go, oh my gosh, things are horrible. I say, what are our options? Okay, we become atheists, we become Eastern Orthodox, we can become Sede Vacantis, we can become Protestant. But the only thing that's consistent with scripture, tradition, and the mind of the church is this idea that we remain the church, we recognize the Pope, and where the Pope has problems, it's super rare. I mean, in 2,000 years, we have, you know, we're focusing on Honorius and John the 22nd. When it does happen, we just resist in those places. We don't resist everything. We don't resist the church or the papacy. We resist in those issues. And we have to patiently bear, like Leo the First said, and Schneider, patiently bear, and even in sorrow and in penance, these errors until they can be resolved in the future. Maybe it'll be a pope 50 years from now. I don't know. But
yeah,
that's the solution. So pray the rosary. We're in Lent. Fast. If you're not fasting every day, fast on Fridays for Pope Francis. It'd be great if he had a moment where he was like John the 22nd. He said, hey, you know what? There's been some things I've said that are wrong. I want to clear those up. I'm really sorry about that. That'd be great. So I'm praying for that. I'm fasting for that. Pray that rosary every day. If you're getting all worked up on this and you're not praying at least 5 decades a day, you're not on the team. You're not. Why even watch these videos? Right? Like, why even care?
Right.
Our Lady of Fatima says you got to pray the rosary every day. So that's the solution. If you're a lay person, that's your job. If you're not doing your job, you can't complain. You can't even, why even be interested in this? So pray the rosary daily. Find good liturgy. Worship God. Honor God. Live your vocation. If you're a parent, be an awesome parent. If you're a priest, be an awesome priest. So follow us on Twitter, like the video, share this video, subscribe, hit the bell. That's it.